The impact of a changing climate on Maine and beyond. A major international summit held in Poland over the past 2 weeks on climate change sought to find common ground on limiting the rise of the global temperature. The summit comes on the heels of a couple of major climate reports that predict dire consequences unless comprehensive action is taken right away. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll hear from experts about just how dire the threats to our environment are here and what areas will be hardest hit by a changing climate. We'll also learn about what different industries, as well as individuals, can do to help protect our environment from what's being called a climate emergency. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. The news about global climate change has been alarming lately. A recent national climate assessment warned of the need to take rapid action to avert irreversible harm to our planet. Today, we'll talk about what that means for Maine and whether we as individuals can make a difference. Joining me in the studio, Andrew Pershing. He is Chief Scientific Officer with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and he contributed to the recent National Climate Report. David Herring, he's Executive Director of Wolf's Neck Center for Agriculture and the Environment. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Sean Burkle. He's Research Assistant Professor and Maine State Climatologist with the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your concerns about climate change? Have you taken any measures or made changes in your life to try to reduce your impact on the environment? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here. Sean, I wanted to start with you just because we are just coming off of the weekend's news that the global climate summit that was in Poland just wrapped up, and I understand that some of your colleagues were there. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was about and what came out of it?
Yes, the meeting COP24 in Poland was it's a United Nations convention that brings together countries from across the globe, and they're charged with trying to, in this particular meeting, decide on a means to move forward from the Paris Climate Accords. And the University of Maine Climate Change Institute had a delegation there. It was a two-week program, and we had members who were there for both weeks observing the various conferences that were going on and seeing how the communication between parties was going. And the ultimate goal was to establish a means of moving forward with actual commitments towards working towards the Paris Accords. But as I'm sure you saw in the news, the results were more limited than people had hoped at the beginning.
Okay, but not as bad as it could have been, so it's somewhere in the middle of what came out of that
right,
summit?
There was a general agreement on how to move forward, but it remains non-binding. Okay. And because the United States did not commit as strongly as people had hoped, that seemed to... it could have worked out better if the conditions had been slightly different.
Right. Okay. Andrew, I wanted to hear from you a bit. You were involved with the recent National Climate Assessment on the oceans and marine resources part of that report, and your colleague also worked on the Northeast chapter of that assessment. And the overall message I think that people got from that report, which was just released after Thanksgiving, was that things are worse than we thought, and that the entire world needs to do everything we can in the face of a very pressing emergency.
Yeah, so that came out very strongly in our research. So I led the Oceans and Marine Resources chapter, and with my co-authors, we were really asked to look over the last several years, what have we learned about how climate impacts ocean resources in the United States? How is that going to change, and how does that affect people in the United States? And so one of the things that we identified was that there are really big changes going on in the ocean in terms of the physical conditions, so temperature, acidification, stratification, deoxygenation, these really big changes in the physical settings, and that's having an impact on ecosystems, and that those impacts are going to continue. And there are a lot of things that we can adapt to and prepare for, But there are a lot of really big changes, especially in places like coral reefs and in the Arctic, where only severe reductions in carbon emissions are going to allow us to hold on to some of the things that are valuable to us.
So not irreversible, though. You're saying there can be some things done, even with the coral reefs, the ones that are pretty far gone.
Well, the challenge is that there's not a lot we can do once a coral reef goes away, because they grow back so slowly. So the main thing that we're trying to do is limit the damage to the reefs that we have right now. And the more carbon that goes in the atmosphere, the more damage that gets accumulated over time. The UN report that came out about 6 months ago, one of the things they really emphasized was how vulnerable coral reefs are, that if we don't keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, or about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, that we could lose 90% of the coral reefs in the world.
So it is pretty depressing, isn't it?
It's depressing, and there's definitely pieces of it that are scary, I would say, or should, you know, people should take, you know, should have some concern over. But the other thing that the report highlights is that there's a lot we can do. The difference between these high CO2 scenarios, where you really see these drastic changes to, you know, to things that we care about, sea level rise in cities, we talked about coral reefs, lots of things all over the world. Those scary things happen in a high CO2 world. If we are serious about reducing carbon emissions, many of those things, you know, go away, and you start to look at a future that looks more or less like the one we have now.
Okay, and Sean, you looked at some of the same issues, but directly here in Maine, on a recent report as well. You worked with Paul Majewski, who's the director of the Climate Change Institute. What was it that you studied, and does the outlook for Maine mirror what we heard in the national assessment that Andrew was describing?
Yes, well, in our report, Coastal Maine Climate Futures, our approach was to review the historical climatology in Maine, the historical climate record, and to assess some subset of commodities to see if there were climate commodity relationships, and also to try a slightly different approach and develop plausible scenarios based on the historical record, climate commodity relationships, and also.
Wait, time out just a second. What is a climate commodity relationship?
Oh, sorry. For an economic commodity, a record of production or a catch of a certain resource. So mm-hmm. in this case, we examined blueberries, mm-hmm. The lobster record, which others, including Andrew, have looked at, and cod, and then to try to make climate connections to that. And we can talk about this more, but part of this goes into connections to the Arctic and the broader North Atlantic climate system. But the report, an important focus of it is to develop plausible scenarios for a relatively short-term outlook, say the next 20 years. So we emphasize from now until 2040. Whereas the National Climate Assessment and other reports tend to look out over the next century and more generally at a global scale, although there are certainly regional discussion aspects to that. But Coastal Maine Climate Futures, we want to focus primarily on coastal Maine over the next 20 years. And we chose that time frame because often what gets overlooked are some of the patterns of variability that we've observed and that we know a great deal about, that global models don't necessarily resolve very well. And so when we talk about future climate projections, much of the information we use in those come from models. And the models are quite good. They work very well at the global scale, and they're able to reproduce quite well the global historical changes that we see. But at the regional scale, some things don't work out quite so well. And so this report, we focus on coastal Maine, the historical record, and then develop plausible scenarios based on that research.
So a lot of this has to do with the data that you collect, and I understand there's a climate analyzer that you use. Can you describe what that is?
Climate Reanalyzer is a website that I've been developing since about 2012, and it's a framework for climate data visualization, and it brings together climate models, weather forecast models, a global array of station data, and provides means for people to produce maps, time series, to get spreadsheets, and in a user-friendly, easy way to be able to access large climate data sets.
Okay. So both of you look a lot more at the coastal side of things, but David, you're focused on the agricultural end. Can you tell us about what Wolf's Next Farm is doing and how that relates to climate change?
Sure. a big part of our work at Wolf's Neck is on training farmers. And when we look at the models that we're using to train farmers in, we're focused heavily on farming practices that are increasingly understood to support both adaptation and mitigation related to climate. Specifically practices such as low or no-till farming methods and other practices that would kind of fall under regenerative agriculture or agroecosystem models that are increasingly looked to in terms of food production and farming models that can be more environmentally friendly into the future.
And that's the tricky thing with agriculture, right? On one hand, farms are contributing a lot to the problem, but on the other hand, they have the potential to be a big solution to the problem. And is that happening in Maine on both ends, I guess?
Well, Maine has some unique challenges, but also unique opportunities. So Maine has a lot of farmland, farm and forest land, that isn't as productive as it could be. So a lot of farmland that formerly was productive. When you look across the landscape in Maine and New England and many other states, Maine has an opportunity to make land more productive. And that productivity, if it is in farmland that's utilizing practices that are kind of fit within a regenerative agriculture model, has a real opportunity both to help with farmer viability and adaptation, but also mitigation by storing more carbon in the soil. And that's really a big part of what we're working on at Wolf's Neck and others are in the sector as well.
So I think we need a little bit to back up with that, storing the carbon in the soil. So on one hand, you have farms that are contributing to climate change because of the transportation and the tilling of the land, like you're saying, releasing carbon, and even the methane from the animals and all of that, right, contributing kind of on the bad side. But then on the good side, you can actually capture carbon. Or what is it, the carbon sequestration? Maybe you can explain that.
Sure. So carbon gets into the soil through photosynthesis. And in order for photosynthesis to take place, to happen, there has to be active plant activity growing on the soil. And so in order for farms to be sequestering carbon and more of a sink than a source, there are a number of practices that have been identified, both low and no-till farming, cover cropping, and those are really kind of low-hanging fruit opportunities that are proven to, over time, help farmers reduce their inputs, but also help increase yields in certain cases. And so the goal really in large part is to keep soil covered. And that's a real shift in the way that, at least on a large scale, large production model scale, that farms across the country have been operating. And there are a lot of efforts both here in Maine and across the country to try and incentivize and support farms to transition to models where they're keeping the soil covered. And that helps reduce erosion. And it helps with water infiltration, and it helps with water storage, and these are things that help adapt. And so with farms there and farms and food production, we have such a considerable opportunity because the practices that help farms adapt are also the practices that can help farms mitigate and store more carbon in the soil.
So they're good to do either way.
Correct.
And the farmers wouldn't have a big objection then to trying to help.
Well, correct, but that's not to say it's not complicated. I wouldn't say that there's an objection, but there's in some cases a transition away from a production model that isn't using these practices, and that transition can be complicated. It can certainly require new skills, new equipment, new knowledge, and so that there's a process there that we're trying to support in the training of new farmers to implement those practices, and so I think that I wouldn't say that there's widespread adoption, but there is an increasing understanding of the power of those approaches.
Okay. Now, Andrew, you talked about ecosystems and how those are kind of one of the big concerns, as opposed to a specific species or a specific area. What happens? What What would you say worries you the most as you worked on this report in terms of what we are able to still rescue?
So, that's a really fascinating question, and there's a lot of depth there. I think when you look at Maine, I think one of the things you would look at is our lobster fishery, where the boom in lobster that we've experienced has been very much a part of the kind of the flip side of climate change. The warming water in the Gulf of Maine has been good for lobsters up to a point. And the question is, at what point is it going to start to tip over? So we've done some modeling, and other folks have as well, that suggests that there's sort of an optimum temperature that we're probably pretty close to, and that additional warming is going to start to constrain our lobster fishery. But the modeling work that we've done suggests that the really strong conservation ethic that's been developed along the coast of Maine, with lobstermen throwing large lobsters back, throwing the small lobsters back, and protecting the egg-bearing females, that gives a certain amount of climate resilience to this fishery and would allow them to hold on to a lot of the value of the fishery in the future. But the challenge is really kind of, once you get past 2040, 2050, where you're really looking at these very different scenarios about the future that are related to how much carbon's in the ocean, that's where things get really different. There, in a high CO2 world, the Gulf of Maine in 2070, 2080 is warm enough that lobster will be very, very challenged.
It sounds like there's actually a deadline for when we need to go to a low CO2 world by a certain date. I mean, is it just a certain mathematical combination of things that makes it that you have to do things by a certain date?
It really is a mathematical computation. I mean, it's just the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the rate that it goes into the atmosphere and the rate that it's coming out. That's kind of the game that we're playing. And the more carbon that stays in the ground, the better the future is. The less we have to do around trying to develop new technologies that have to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The UN report that came out earlier this year was really thinking about, in 10 to 20 years, we have to start making really significant progress in reducing the amount of carbon emissions. That's what it takes in order to limit warming below the 1.5 degrees Celsius target that's sort of put out there for 2050. And if we do that, the climate stabilizes, and many of the changes that we've been talking about, the world looks fairly similar to the one we have now. There are still coral reefs. There are just fewer of them, and they're in some different places. There's still lobster, but it's that high CO2 world we really, really have to avoid.
Okay, lots more to talk about, but we need to take a quick break. So when we come back, your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Green Lion Gallery, committed to affordable original gifts of art from Maine and beyond, in downtown Bath and at greenlionart.com. And the Lincoln Home in Newcastle, committed to providing gracious retirement living on the Damariscotta River. Learn more at lincoln-home.org.
A Cold War-era nuclear weapons treaty is on the verge of falling apart.
If Russia admits its violations and fully and verifiably comes back into compliance, we will, of course, welcome that course of action. Only they can save this treaty.
Why the treaty is on life support and why its demise could trigger an arms race. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public's podcast shortlist is now underway. The shortlist provides access to a wide range of Maine's most informative, interactive, and entertaining podcasts, from politics to craft beer and everything in between. This week's featured podcast episode of the week is the SPOS podcast. They'll have 2018 Wells High School commencement address. Do you have or know a podcast created here in Maine that would be a great addition to the podcast shortlist? Send your suggestions to shortlist@mainepublic.org. The Maine Public Podcast Shortlist is at mainepublic.org. Click on Podcast Shortlist under our radio tab.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, the changing climate in Maine. Joining me, Sean Burkle, research assistant professor and Maine state climatologist based at the Climate Change Institute at University of Maine. David Herring is executive director of Wolf's Neck Center for Agriculture and the Environment, and Andrew Pershing is Chief Scientific Officer with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is Michelle Staudinger. She is Science Coordinator with the Northeast Climate Adaptation Science Center and Adjunct Assistant Professor with the Department of Environmental Conservation at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Thanks for joining us, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I understand you also contributed to the recently released National Climate Assessment, and you worked on the previous national report 4 years ago. What does your research focus on?
Well, here at the Northeast Climate Adaptation Science Center, we focus on how climate change is impacting natural and cultural resources in the Northeast. And my research focuses particularly on coastal and marine ecosystems. I'm very interested in how species are responding to climate change through shifts in their phenology, which is also known as the timing of recurring life events. These are things such as migration patterns and reproduction schedules.
And so the Gulf of Maine, I guess, has a lot of these species that you look at, and it's one of the fastest warming bodies of water in the world. What is happening in the Gulf because of those warming waters?
Right. So we're seeing the timing of our seasons changing throughout the Northeast, and especially in the Gulf of Maine. We're seeing spring arrive earlier. We're seeing longer summers and shorter winters. And this is affecting the timing of when we see plants blooming and in the oceans, when we see our large phytoplankton blooms. And this has effects that cascade up the food chain to affect higher level species such as fishes and seabirds and whales, and the timing of when they come here to forage and reproduce.
Does the timing, the phenology, synchronize? If they're all moving north for colder waters, is everybody moving together, or does it get off base?
Right. So phenological responses are highly species specific and often population specific. So you can see a species respond in one way in one place and in a totally another way, or not at all, in another part of its range. And we often see these differences creating asynchronies. So that's one of the biggest concerns that we have, is that we'll have mismatches in resources as well as in between species that rely on each other for food. And in some cases, this will increase competition. It might decrease competition in other ways. But basically, things are all over the place with the way that they're responding to different environmental drivers.
Then are there particular species that are the most vulnerable right now that people are the most concerned about?
Well, that's a large part of what my research is trying to figure out. We're still somewhat in the early stages of understanding shifting phenology in marine environments. It's much more difficult to detect phenological responses in species that live underwater. It's much more easy to go out to your favorite tree in your backyard and see the leaves starting to burst in the spring, or the daffodils flowering in your yard. Those are predictable events that occur in a particular location year after year. In the ocean, species move around, and they're very difficult to see. So we're trying to figure out which species are actually shifting their phenology, how much they're shifting, and whether that's misaligning with the resources that they depend on. So a couple of the species that I'm very interested in are seabirds, right whales, and river herring, which are anadromous fish that move between marine and freshwater. So we're seeing some evidence of shifts in all of these species, and we're trying to figure out how that is affecting their vulnerability right now, and we're still working on that.
So bottom line, I guess, we're trying to find out from all of you, is there a place for hope, or are they really kind of a done deal, to say it not nicely, I guess? I mean, how hopeful are you that we are able to stem some of the damage that's being done?
Well, I think understanding species adaptive capacity, and I think I heard Andy speaking to this earlier, is really important. Species do have this inherent ability to have some flexibility to respond to the environment. And so they should be able to keep up at some extent, but depending on how fast the environment changes and how much climate change we experience is really going to determine which species are going to make it in the future and which ones aren't. So again, as I heard Andy mentioning earlier, the decisions and the choices that we make right now are going to be really important to determining how much carbon is going to be released into the atmosphere.
Oops. I think we're
going to experience.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Michelle. Michelle Staudinger is with the Northeast Climate Adaptation Science Center. She's based at UMass Amherst. And what she mentioned, which we want to talk about, is that there are ways that people can help. Sean, I just wanted to ask you, in following up there, and is Maine a leader in this area in trying to do something about climate change?
Yes, Maine has been a leader, and it was the first state in the last decade to adopt a concerted effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that was the University of Maine was involved in that effort. And I would like to mention, I feel hopeful overall that certainly on the adaptation side that we can make good progress. And also Maine itself in this part of the world, although there will certainly be some negative impacts, including extreme rainfall events, sea level rise, coastal erosion, I think we fare pretty well in comparison to other parts of the globe. For example, Maine is projected to get wetter, which should be good for agriculture overall, although there could be an increase in damaging rainfall events. A lengthening of the growing season, that should be an overall benefit to most sectors of the economy, certainly for agriculture. Of course, with that comes a diminished snow season, which will affect wintertime recreation, and certainly it will have effects on the natural environment. And so I just wanted to highlight that there are positive aspects of this, and there are certainly negative aspects, but we should be hopeful that at least in terms of adaptation and where we are in Maine, I think things should be have the potential, if we do take some actions now, to address mitigation and stave off the worst of the changes that happen 50, 60 years from now, then I think we'll pull through.
Okay. It's time to go to the callers because everybody, I think, has something to say about this. We have Peter calling from York. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. What did you want to talk about?
The part about the whole equation is the conservation, that the fish have done that very well. Great white sharks cruise at about one knot or less, and yet they can capable of very high speeds. So they conserve their energy. There are many animals that have interesting covers on them to keep them warm like sheep. So why don't we just put a blanket around our houses? And the trick is do one wall a year and the roof the last year. And we did some calculations at MIT back in the 70s, and it turns out that if you do about R70 in the roof, R50 in the walls, and R30 under the slab or under the basement, that you can do away with your oil furnace. Now, this sounds kind of drastic, but it's just a simple analysis of heat flow and the insulation needed to slow it down. So by doing it in 5 years, you've basically preserved your old age in your own home with a very low cost, and your garden can be in your front lawn like people have shown here in Scarborough in the past. So I think that people need to be more optimistic, like Bucky Fuller used to be in his talks to the people, and I was fortunate to hear about three of them.
Great. And, thank you. Thank you, Peter, for sharing that. We have a lot of good ideas coming in from others as well. We have Barry on Facebook saying the house and car that he has are 100% net zero using solar panels, heat pump, and a used Leaf electric car. He says it's a lot less expensive to do than people think, and he's also boycotted air travel Total household carbon footprint is about 600 pounds per year compared to a national average of 22 tons. So, David, you have also some ideas of what people can do, especially linked to agriculture.
Well, it's great to hear the ideas coming in off of Facebook there around energy and transportation, but food is such a big part of our lives, and some studies are showing that the food system represents more than a third of our global greenhouse gas emissions are tied to the food system, both from a farming production side and from a processing and distribution. So, you know, when you think about the food system, it's somewhat overwhelming to think about we're not all going to grow all of our own food to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the same way that we could with our transportation or our cars. And so it's really largely about supporting those food producers and farmers that are putting in place the practices that are helping kind of the greater good. A second piece of that is, you know, I think we all need to look at our diets and think about whether or not there are shifts in what we're eating, when we're eating it, eating more seasonally, that would be more in line with what farmers in our region can produce.
I think that a lot of people, when that national climate assessment came out, were feeling kind of helpless and thinking, gosh, you know, it's so bad. What could I possibly do to make a dent? And so there was a lot of focus on what you eat as one of the things you can do and reducing, for example, beef because of its impact on the environment. Is that really something that can make a dent?
You know, we make food choices multiple times a day. Some of us don't have access to the same amount of food that others do, but those of us who do and those of us who have the means to make choices that are that can make a meaningful impact across the globe, we need to do that. And for a lot of us, I think that means right-sizing our portions, and perhaps that does mean for some people reducing their meat intake, depending on how large of a portion we're talking about, and focusing more on plant-based diets. And the meat and seafood that we eat should be, to the greatest extent possible, produced locally or regionally and produced in organic or regenerative production systems.
Great. Okay. Andy.
And this is such a fascinating problem because, it's one of the things that's most insidious about the climate change problem is that I think our individual actions, while they're important, we really need concerted effort on a planetary scale to affect this problem. And so I think the way we've been starting to think about it is in terms of, you know, lots of different levels. So there's an international level, and Sean spoke to the work that was being done in Poland to try to get international agreements that will try to get every country moving in the same direction. There's the national level, and there's lots of talk on sort of, you know, some national movement potentially around carbon policy over the next few years. The state has things that it can do, and our state has been a real leader. I think the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that Maine helped start years ago has been a huge success in limiting the amount of carbon dioxide emissions from the New England power grid. And then you get down to kind of the community and the local scale and the scale of our individual decisions. And while, you know, the fact that, I drove here in a particular way or walked, you know, that might not matter in the grand scheme of things, There's a real need for leadership all across these levels, and individual leadership, individual choices, they matter, and they help incentivize, you know, changes in the marketplace. You just look at the changes that are going on in transportation. How, you know, the most coveted car in the world right now is an electric car. Mm-hmm. Now most of us can't afford them or can't get on the waiting list to get them, but you know, I think everybody would like to have a Tesla. At least I would.
Well, also what you were saying about, you know, sort of leadership for the next generation. I think the new generation of kids coming up are growing up really caring about this and actually making those changes. And the sum total of that seems like it would make a difference.
It is a huge generational problem. And you see that reflected in how in the politics and voting patterns. You see that in terms of the level of concern that and it really is a generational problem. And I mean, I was just reflecting on this today. My son had his, had a birthday on Sunday, and you know, the temperature that we're dealing with right now in the atmosphere was due to the carbon that was emitted when we were driving him home from the hospital 21 years ago, right? I mean, that's sort of the challenge that 20 years from now is when the carbon that we emitted when we, you know, when we drove around this morning. That's when that starts to get fully priced into the climate system. So it's a huge intergenerational problem.
Wow, lots of layers to think about. We're going to take another quick break, but first a word about tomorrow's show. We have a somewhat more lighthearted topic. We'll be talking about donuts and why Maine is such a donut-centric state. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. And the Maine Association of Nonprofits, empowering Maine nonprofits to adapt, thrive, and contribute in a fast and changing world. Nonprofitmaine.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, in the past 50 years, there is a good chance you have watched Sesame Street, either as a child or perhaps with your child. The show does more than help children learn to spell. It helps them understand everything from autism to incarceration to refugees. Sherry Weston of Sesame Workshop will join us to explain how Sesame Street's Muppets are helping shape the world's children on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
I'm Karen Duffin from Planet Money. We are NPR's show that finds economic lessons in odd places, like the world's longest yard sale. We went this summer, 6 states in 3 days, and in Tennessee, we tried to buy a pretender's record.
As long as this has 2,000 miles, then we need it.
But the owner decided he did not want to sell it to us.
I feel like the sale already happened. The box was out here.
You hid this on the bottom.
No.
I didn't look close enough.
And there's an economic term for this. It's called the endowment effect, which basically means as soon as you own something, it becomes more valuable to you. You already value this station, and when you make a year-end gift, it's like owning your own little piece of public radio. So go ahead, make public radio even more valuable to you by making it yours. Here's how.
Make your year-end donation today at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Tackling Climate Change. Joining us today, David Herring is with Wolf's Neck Center for Agriculture and the Environment. Andrew Pershing is with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and Sean Burkle with UMaine's Climate Change Institute. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And we're going to go now to Suzette McAvoy. She's the Executive Director of the Center for Maine Contemporary Art. Hi, Suzette. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in to alert your panel and your listeners to an upcoming exhibition that we're hosting at CMCA in Rockland in 2019 called Meltdown, which presents the work of 10 Maine artists whose work is really addressing the issue of climate change on the fragile environments of the Arctic and Antarctic. And the exhibition will be on view from March 23rd to June 9th of next year and features the work of mostly photographers or, as we call them, lens-based artists these days. People are working with both photography and video. And using their art to bring this message of really the irrefutable fact of climate change to a larger audience.
That's interesting. It's not something we think of when we think about taking on climate change. Do you feel there's an avenue for the arts in actually changing people's minds or teaching them something?
Yes. Well, the show is really based on a quote from Per Epstein Snokness, which in his book that he wrote called What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, he says, if engaging with climate is not a matter of winning, but more a matter of character and style, then the making of art, story, and literature also becomes part of our responses. And I think artists these days are really, see it as part of their mission and calling to use their voice to you know, make this message maybe more visible or more visceral to the audience in a way that maybe data and science, you know, isn't getting through to some people. So we're really looking forward to bringing this exhibition, and it's really a wide-ranging show, and through the course of the exhibition, we'll also be hosting a number of panel discussions, both with the artists and scientists, on the way that art and science can work together in trying to get the message out.
Well, great, Suzette. We'll try to post something about that on our Facebook page. Suzette McAvoy is Executive Director of the Center for Maine Contemporary Art. And we'll go to a call now from Ray, calling from Beals. Hi, Ray. What did you want to ask our panelists?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The question I have relates to the ocean. How much do scientists have any idea as to how much carbon molecules are in the oceans? And I'm particularly concerned about methane, since that's so much worse than carbon dioxide in terms of its volatility.
Thank you, Ray. Andrew, do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, so about 25% of the carbon, the extra carbon dioxide that humans have released into the atmosphere from burning coal and oil has gone into the ocean. And that's why the oceans are getting more acidic. So as CO2 goes into the atmosphere, it gets mixed with ocean water, and that makes the ocean more acidic. And, you know, your question about methane is a really, really interesting one. That was something that was called out in the Climate Center, in the National Climate Assessment, as a sort of a real risk that's out there, that in the Arctic, especially where you have a lot of methane that's stored in the permafrost, both on land and in the water, as things warm up, you can release that methane into the atmosphere. And the worry is that if that were to happen, that leads to more warming than we're anticipating in the climate models. And I'm sort of curious maybe whether Sean has thought about that in terms of some of the scenarios.
Sean?
Well, I think that the excess release of methane is very important because the Arctic is warming faster than any other place on the globe. And in Alaska and also Siberia, places that have had permafrost for human history are now thawing. And in the Siberian Arctic in particular, there are preserved mammoth bones coming out of the permafrost because it's melting so quickly. So we're talking thousands of years. And in the most extreme scenarios of steep increase in greenhouse gas emissions, those areas will lose permafrost very rapidly, and there'll be more methane going into the atmosphere, which is has more than 10 times the impact of CO2, although it's shorter lived in the atmosphere. But this is a huge part of the problem. It's not just CO2, but it's also methane.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for calling, Ray. I just wanted to loop back to something Sean also mentioned earlier about there are some benefits, especially being in Maine, to a warming climate here. Is that something that, we might do a little better here because we can afford to warm up, or is that not the way it works?
I guess.
Well, I think overall.
Go ahead.
Oh,
Sean.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, sorry. I think overall, there are many negative aspects of the warming climate. That goes without saying. It's something that societies around the world need to face. But at the same time, we have to accept and adapt to what is likely to happen. And where we live, I think we have it pretty well, because we're not facing extreme drought. There could be seasonal drought. That will continue. But it's not the same dire situation as places such as in the desert belt or semi-arid regions that are getting drier and drier, where places that rely completely on irrigation. And California, for example, the cities in California are likely to face some pretty severe challenges in the future because of the lack of water. In Maine, Maine will get wetter. That's what the projections show, and that's what the historical record shows. We'll have to manage some of that water if extreme rainfall events continue, because that can damage agriculture. And but we're in a good place, and in fact, we may see the population grow because if people migrate from places that have more negative impacts, they may come to the Northeast.
Huh. Okay. Well, thanks. We're going to go.
Especially as the winters cool, yeah, are warm, because
it makes it a little more comfortable here. We're going to take a call now from Jim in Presque Isle. Hi, Jim. Thanks for waiting. What's your question?
Hey, good afternoon. I'll be very brief because I've seen what happened in Casco Bay over the last 40 years of the degradation of the seawater, and I would guess that that's almost entirely based on the amount of chemical that goes into that rather closed system called Casco Bay from all the lawn care that takes place, not to mention some agricultural runoff as well. So my question really is, did the degradation of the lobster population in the southern New England area result from warming water or from excessive chemicals in the seawater?
Oh.
Yeah, so if you look overall in the southern stock, and this was one of the things we did in a study that we released earlier this year, it's very clear that warming was the main driver of the decline in lobsters in southern New England. But you're absolutely right, though, that chemical runoff can play a role, and there's some evidence that played a role in a big die-off that occurred in Long Island during a particularly warm summer after a rain event. It was just kind of a perfect storm of really terrible conditions for lobster in Long Island. But Rhode Island, southern Massachusetts, they didn't have that same issue. And there it's really been the warming that's driven the decline.
David, has there been much work with farmers and pesticide use?
Say the question one more time, Cindy.
Have you focused much on the use of pesticides and whether that, you know, there's efforts to reduce that?
You know, there are efforts that are going on. That's not specifically an effort that we're involved in at Wolf's Neck, but there are a lot of efforts happening both across the state and around the country that are focused on enabling farmers to adapt to different methods that would reduce their inputs and really focusing more on soil health and building soil carbon and as a way to both adapt and mitigate and so.
Okay, great. We have from Martin on Facebook three practical things we can all do. One, recycle plastic bags. Bring them to any Walmart. They get made into composite decking. Don't put plastic bags in curbside recycling. They won't get recycled that way and it jams up the system. Two, cut down on use of small engines. Snowblowers and lawnmowers do not have the same emissions controls that cars do. Half-hour mowing your lawn is the same emissions as driving your SUV to Boston and back. And number three, recycle nips, the small liquor bottles, with the new bottle deposits starting on January 1st. So thank you, Martin. And we will go now to a question from Phil in Camden. Hi, Phil, you're on the line.
Hi. I have a question about why it is with this type of program that people rarely seem to talk about what could be the low-hanging fruit. And by that, I mean, for example, agriculture certainly is important. Globally, it's around 30%. But in the United States, where we have some control over our lives, according to the EPA, it's around 9%. And agricultural energy use itself is actually quite low, whereas transportation and electricity together is pushing, electric production together is pushing about 60%. These are areas where stronger public policy could make a huge difference. And it's possible that the CAFE standards on automobiles could have been lowered many years ago with probably very little harm to the economy. And, of course, we already know that there's some other methods of producing electricity, but that the implementation of those methods has been very slow. I guess what I always, maybe it's because people feel a little helpless, why is it that there isn't more emphasis on taking care of the things that we can easily take care of? I guess that's the heart of my question.
Okay, thanks, Phil. Any ideas about the low-hanging fruit?
I mean, I think Phil really nailed it in a way. I mean, you both the challenge and the opportunity. I mean, the challenge is that we have a society that depends on us using electricity. We all expect to be able to drive around in a car or fly in an airplane wherever we want to go. And those are big emission sources. And so it's just really challenging for us to to affect that on a large scale, which is what you're talking about with public policy. So it's been very dicey politically to get to that. But at the same time, I think we've seen a lot of really great changes and just a real explosion in what individuals can do. So LED light bulbs are a great way to reduce your local electrical use. There are other ways you can think about heating your home if that's something that, if you're thinking about replacing a furnace. The transportation sector is changing very quickly. And I think the question is it changing fast enough to get to the emissions reductions that we need? And then is there public policy that's out there that's going to help us to accelerate that change?
One simple thing I read about for all the business travel is just to video conference more now that we have that technology. People flying all over the place to these conferences.
Yeah, it's getting a lot better, certainly. And I think it takes a cultural shift. Like sitting in on a meeting that's run on a video conference is very different than the natural interaction face-to-face, just like it's harder for us to include Sean and Bangor in the conversation than it is the three of us sitting here in the room.
Hi, Sean. Sean, did you want to weigh in on that? As far as the low-hanging fruit idea, what are some basic things that can be done?
Well, I think what Andy just said is very nicely framed. And we do what we can do, and we can make some personal changes, and whether it's limiting air travel or choosing what type of cars we drive, I think it is very important. I really don't know what else to say in that regard other than those are very important points.
Right. I have a quick email from Emily in Portland. Recently bought a hybrid, and I do garbage to garden composting, but I want to know if the panelists have heard of any incentives for home buyers to go green from the state or from other places.
Yeah, I know that there's Maine does have some incentives for things like replacing furnaces and some sort of major home improvements to help make that possible. From time to time, there are tax incentives around electric vehicles or solar, and quite honestly, I'm not up to speed on exactly where we are with those. But my understanding is that's something that the new governor is thinking very seriously about.
Okay. And David, I think you still had a couple other quick suggestions of things that people can do, and that'll be it for today.
Well, no one can do everything, but everybody can do something. And when you think about we're eating three times a day, hopefully if we're lucky, and to be more thoughtful about our food choices, where we're shopping, the types of food that we're buying, and trying to eat more locally and more seasonally, and support organic farmers as much as possible. These are relatively simple things to do, but if done on a large scale, I think we're going to be able to shift the practices of the farmers that supply to some of the big food businesses out there across the country and around the globe. And our hope is that there can be a real shift in the way that food is produced in the future, that there has to be a real shift.
Okay, some great ideas for everyone to do their small part. Thank you all for joining us today. Andrew Pershing, Chief Scientific Officer with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. David Herring is Executive Director of Wolf's Neck Center for Agriculture and the Environment. And Sean Burkle is Research Assistant Professor and Maine State Climatologist based out of the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. Nikki Shields ran the board today. We also had help from George Thomas. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8. Tomorrow on the show, it's all about donuts. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.